I'm an alcoholic and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Brooks Bell. Hi, fellas. I haven't had a drink of whiskey all day today. The steps, traditions, and the grace has kept me that way since October 17, 1973. I got to tell you, I ain't got a clue how that happened. I got to tell you, I don't speak for AA as a whole. I got to tell you, I don't know how the program works. I think it has something to do with love and service. I think it has something to do with not taking a drink of whiskey. I think it has something to do with home groups and winos like us. You know, we pretty near insist on having a good time, all of us. This is your conference. I've been to all of these, and I'm very grateful for that. My story is just like anybody else's, you know. I drank just the right amount of whiskey to get here. One more drink would kill me, and one less, and I wouldn't have needed it. I was not one of these guys that walked in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous pitching his hat in the air, hollering, "Boy, what a good deal this is." I've seen very few of those come in like that. And when you see them come in like that, you need to get them someplace real quiet, because they're fixing to have a spiritual experience, and you're going to watch it. You know, I saw a fella come in like that one time saying, "Boy, what a good deal this is." He become a flopper at the next meeting. I guarantee you, he caught every newcomer's attention that had been in the whole deal. You know, if you ain't had a drop become a flopper on you, you need to go to some different meetings. You know, you're not getting any newcomers at your group. I'm going to tell you a couple of things that have been important in my sobriety. One of them occurred early on for me, and I'm really grateful for it. And one of them occurred just last fall. I don't know how meaningful it'll be to you, but it's plenty meaningful to me. I'll talk to you a little bit about the steps and what I think they're all about and what they've done for me. I'll try and share with you my little old drunkalogue. You know, it's dull like hell, you know. I ain't never been in jail yet. I ain't had a DWI yet. I ain't been in prison yet. Whiskey man pretty well dissolved some stuff like a job and a marriage and, you know, that stuff. But that old solvent alcohol will do that, you know. I've seen it dissolve lots of stuff. On Christmas Day, 1973, I was home in my little apartment, and I'd gone and played Disneyland Daddy to those two lovely children of that alcoholic marriage that had just been dissolved. And I'd bought a whole bunch of stuff that I couldn't possibly afford to win back the love, the esteem, and the affection that I so richly deserved at being 60 days sober. And that was all done by about 9 o'clock. When I got home to my little apartment, my blazing 60 days, and I commenced to read the paper. I was fixing to go over that day to my dearest friend's house, who was still drinking and who was to continue to drink for another 7 years after that. And I was to sit down and have Christmas dinner with him and his wife and his various environs and stuff, family and things. I had me a drinking girlfriend. If we got any fellas that are new or any fellas that are coming back, it is not advisable to have a drinking girlfriend. And my drinking girlfriend was fixing to come over to my apartment and bring me a real Christmas present, I hope. And so as I read the paper and waited for this to happen, there was a little prayer in the paper. And I read that and said, "Well, what a good deal that is." I said, "How interesting." And I continued to read the paper. And I read over in the sports section. And I turned back and I read that little prayer again. I said, "That's so nice." And I read over in the business section and I turned back and read that little prayer again, and I said, "What a good deal that is." And then the next time I looked at the little prayer, I said, "Well, I better cut that out." of the paper, because I'm liable to need that one of these days. And so I went to the kitchen and got a knife. Fellows that are divorced do not have scissors. Some of you might know. And I got a knife, and I cut that little prayer out, and I read it again as I cut it out. And fellas, let me tell you what happened to me. And I hope that it happens to you. Because at that particular moment in my life, 60 days dry, something happened to me as I read that prayer again. And I knew deep, deep, deep inside within me, I knew that I never had to drink again. I knew that I didn't have anything to do with that. I knew that left to my own devices, I'd be drunker than a road lizard. But the miracle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous had started to work for me. And you see, fellas, what I knew is that God had done for me what I couldn't do for myself. Because you see, the miracle of the miracles was not that I hadn't had a drink. The miracle of the miracles, gentlemen, is that I didn't want one. That's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If we've got anybody new, if we've got anybody coming back, if we've got anybody that's perilously close to a drink, if you don't hear anything else I say, hear what I say right now. You absolutely never, ever, as long as you live, have to drink again for any reason. That's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what we've done for 56 years. That's what we're about, fellas. We're about not drinking whiskey. You never have to drink again as long as you live. Some of you will. Look at the fellow sitting next to you. Look at the fellow sitting behind you. Look at the fellow sitting in front of you. And come back in 5 years and see who's here. I know that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works a day at a time. But you may absolutely rest assured that I fully intend never to drink again as long as I live. Not as long as I live. I might. We're all one think away from a drink, one drink away from a drunk. You see, the phenomenon of craving is what separates me from the folks that can drink normally. You know, they don't experience that. I do. I've got 2 grown children, a couple of grandchildren. I've got a new wife. I took a 17-year AA relationship made in heaven and have made a 6-month marriage out of it, and folks said it wouldn't last. My wonderful wife, Val, says, "Don't get the line." I said, "All right, honey, I won't." She has a couple of kids that I helped raise. I didn't raise my own children very much. I had a little boy and a little girl. They're about 25, 26, and 24 now. Four years ago, my daughter was a 19-year-old virgin with $500,000, given her not by me, but her grandfather. On the day before Thanksgiving, she arrived back in her hometown, destitute, with no resources. The soon-to-be unmarried mother of one that she'd lost, having made her living down in South Texas as best she could for the last 6 or 8 months. She arrived back in her hometown with a pair of blue jeans, a dirty shirt, and a pair of bloody panties, where she'd traded sex to 2 fellows to get back to this town. She'd been abused physically and emotionally, had been in jail for writing hot checks, and had no resources. Her mother and I got together and got her into the MHMR system in her area. And she went to a state hospital to recuperate. Today, as I share with you, she is in a halfway house in her hometown. This is a young woman that has never prospered in life, has never done well, and left to her own devices. Her decision-making capacity is nil. I have a place that I love more than life itself, and it's a hunting and fishing club I belong to down at Athens. And I was down at Athens the day after Thanksgiving, and I had my son and his wife and my grandson, Bubba. Bubba, who is 3 and thinks I'm plenty keen. Bubba, to tell you the truth, thinks I'm the berries, as a matter of fact. And had Val's married daughter and her husband and another daughter that I felt that I raised myself, Amy. And I was completely surrounded by the people that loved me the most and the people that I loved the most. And I woke up Saturday morning early, as I do, and I turned to my wife and I said, "Honey, I'm not doing well with this thing with our daughter." And I wept and I cried and I cursed you and me and God and screamed into the pillow for 30 minutes. And you see, fellas, what had happened to me is sometimes the pain of sobriety becomes so great that we do one of 3 things. We make the ultimate sacrifice. We lip a 38 or take a drink of whiskey, and there's absolutely no difference in the world. Or we talk to another alcoholic, and we come around the corner. And what happened on that deal is that I talked to another alcoholic and came around the corner, and I'm okay with that today. I don't like it worth a flip, but I don't have to. Life is life, fellas. And life still keeps coming at you. But absolutely rest assured that you never have to drink again as long as you live. Not ever. That's the message. Social drinkers. You know, you look around this room here. You know, AA, you know, you look in any AA hall you go into. And let me tell you, I belong to the best AA club in the Southwest region, in the United States, in the North American continent, and in the world. I belong to the Alno Group on Maple Avenue, right next door to the Cadillac Bar. The Cadillac Bar is closed down. We done them in, fellas. The biggest bar in Dallas County, we done put them out of business, I guarantee you. While it was ginning, it was really kind of nice because you didn't have too far either to do one of 2 things. You could make a 12-step call, or you could go take a drink. It wasn't no big deal. But, you know, but I and that little old group is 5925 Maple Avenue, between Inwood and Mockingbird, just to the south of Love Field. If you don't like your group, come to mine. Mine's the best. Either that you can do one of 2 things. You can either go to yours and make it better, or you can come to mine. If you come to mine, don't screw it up. We're fine-tuning it. Been in business about 20 years. Got it just about right now. Don't be screwing with it. We're doing all right. That's my Alno group in Dallas. But, you know, you walk into an AA hall, and you look around, and folks that wouldn't ordinarily mix. And, you know, and those of us that have got a little gray hair, some of us got a little gray hair, some of us got a little hair. and you know, and us wise deacons is what, bleeding deacons is what they call us. You know, so we sit on the back row and be smart is what we do. And we judge these folks when we come in. I got through giving the steps over a little old group not too far from my house, and they had all these kids come up there like this, this spiky hair like this. I guarantee goddamn tea. Now, when I got through them, the old hair laid down like that. Got them about half fixed. But you know, we folks, it wasn't ordinarily mixed, and you know, and we, I kind of sit back there, and me and Larry and, you know, Dave, you know, we watch folks come in. Say, ah, you know, look at that one. Say, ooh, that one will never make it. Ah, that one don't stand to cut a dog's chains. Say, boy, it'll be a cold day in hell before that one ever picks up a 30-day chip. You know, that old deal said, we don't judge, but we do. Yeah, we judge. Then they pick up a 30-day chip, and you say, well, I wonder how that happened. When I sobered up, they didn't even have no 60-day chips. Now they got 60-day chips that are really ugly, made out of metal and stuff. When I sobered up, they gave plastic chips with genuine gold chains through them. They don't do that anymore. And then they get a 60-day chip or a 90-day chip, and you kind of look at, and you listen to them in a discussion meeting, and they're talking the language of the heart. You say, how did that happen? And then one of them will ask you to sponsor them. And you say, well, now this one here, this one is going to make it now. and then the next thing you know, they just go out and get drunk on a road lizard. And you say, well, what happened? Who knows? But it's kind of like the little, you know, it reminds me of the story of the little fellow riding along on a tricycle. And there was a chuck hole in the sidewalk and a preacher standing over behind a tree. And he hit that chuck hole, and it flipped him over the handlebars. And old handlebars went like this, and knocked a big hole in the rim of the tricycle like this, knocked the hide off his little hands, knocked the knees out of his britches. And he got up, and he was bleeding, and his little old britches was ripped and all this business. And he looked around and said, well, son of a bitch. And the preacher stepped up from behind a tree and said, son, says, if that ever happens again, call on the Lord. Say, help me, Jesus. He said, well, all right. 2 or 3 weeks later, little boy, same sidewalk, same preacher, same chuck hole, same tree. Preacher walking along, saw a little boy coming, hit that chuck hole, pitched him over the front of the tricycle, handlebars went like this, knocked a big hole in the tire like that, skinned his little hands again, knocked the hide out of his britches. Little boy got up, put his hands on his little belt like that, and looked around and said, well, help me, Jesus. And his little old hands healed up. The knees come back in his britches. He quit bleeding. The tire come back around on that tricycle. And the handlebars straightened up just like that. Preacher stepped out from behind the tree and said, well, son of a bitch. Every now and then one of them monkeys that walk in that look a little funny, they get them a year chip. And you just step back and say, well, son of a bitch. I drank for 20 years, fellas. I got drunk the first time when I was 15, got drunk the last time when I was 35. First time I got drunk, I had some vodka and some orange juice and some 7-Up and some juice out of them candied cherries and some sugar, and I mixed it all together, and it made me fit in, and it made me wonderful, and it made me drunk, and it made me throw up. That pattern was to continue for 20 years. Only the throwing up quit, and I quit putting all that junk in that whiskey. I got no experience in social drinking. You know, have y'all ever watched any social drinkers? Let me tell you now. They'll get a jigger with a line on it. And they'll get a little glass. You know, like a 8 or a 10 ounce glass. And they'll fill it smooth, lipping full of ice. And they'll take the bottle of whiskey and they'll hold the jigger away from the glass, not even over the glass, and pour it up smooth with the line. And pour it into that drink. And then get some 7-Up, some tonic, some soda, some do-do-do-do-do, you know, water, whatever. Not much whiskey in the glass. And fill it up to the top with that other stuff. And then they'll get a big, long spoon and stir it around like this here. And then they'll get a napkin and put it down on the bottom. And walk around and just every now and then take a drink and go. I never trusted people like that. And then you can ask them stuff like, well, you want another drink? And they'll say, oh no, I'm beginning to feel this one. They'll say, oh no, ain't supper ready? Or they'll say something strange like, oh no, I've got to drive. Let me tell you something. You know, and then they'll walk around up in the night, and the ice will melt, and the napkin will get soggy, and just every now and then they'll get a little swallow. And then it'll be about half full, and I say, well, it's time to go, and they'll put it down and walk away from it. I got no experience doing that, fellas. That's a social drinker. You know what that is? That's sick drinking. Let me tell you something. If I was to take the drink tomorrow that I postponed today, let's go get a case of half a gallons of J&B Scotch whiskey. Let's go get a case of half a gallons of 100-proof Smirnoff vodka. Let's take the lids off all of them and throw away. Let's get a 32-ounce glass, damn little ice, and no mixer at all, and let's do some drinking. Because you see, if I took the drink tomorrow that I postponed today, that's exactly the way I drink, because I got no skills at social drinking. My idea of social drinking is, well, I believe, somebody say, well, I believe I'll go get me a drink, and I say, well, social I. That's social drinking as far as I'm concerned, you know. And that river of denial, you know, for me, an alcoholic, I got to remember that the denial is not a river in Egypt. You know, that's one of them deals that denial ripped through my life for 20 years, that I could drink normally, I could drink safely, I could drink sanely. I read in a big blue book somewhere, that, and it's catching on in most groups as I understand it, that that, you know, the thought that somebody would be able to drink normally is the object of every abnormal drinker. You know, we think about that. You know, I got no experience of drinking normally. You know, I went to the University of Oklahoma, young fella, had a date with my high school sweetheart, came home Texas Oklahoma weekend, 1956. Had a date with her, went downtown, drank a half pint of or a pint of Jack Daniel's Black Label whiskey in about 20 minutes. And that was during the years of the Ivy League deal. How the Ivy League ever got to Norman, Oklahoma, I got no earthly idea. But the kids dressed up there just like they dressed at SMU now. They got little old shirts like this with buttons on them, and then they had buckles on the back of their breeches rather than having it on your shoes. You know, if you had them on your shoes, you was probably a little light in your loafers or something. But so in about 20 minutes, they lead me along by the buckle on the back of my breeches, and they put me in my car, and I made a scientific discovery. I found out that I felt the need to call Ralph. And as I controlled my drinking later on, that's something else that social drinkers don't have to do. I found out they don't have to control their drinking. What a weird thought that is. You know, as I controlled my drinking a little wine, drinking wine in the morning is a bitch, man. But it's better than drinking that brown whiskey. Let me tell you something, fellas. Do not drink brown whiskey before noon. If you drink brown whiskey before noon, chances are more than likely you're an alcoholic. You need to drink that clear whiskey before noon, not vodkas and gin and rums and stuff like that. No brown whiskey before noon. You're drinking brown whiskey, for you drinking that scotch, you drinking that bourbon, you drinking that brandy, you're probably an alcoholic. You probably are. I hate to tell you. Don't drink that brown whiskey before noon. But when I was controlling my drinking a little wine, I felt the need to call Ralph quite often. And I'd go to the porcelain altar with the reflecting bowl in it. And from the bottom of my toes, I'd say, Ralph, like that, and run out my nose, and I'd call his friend Huey. And so that evening in 1956, I felt the need to call Ralph out the back window of that 1956 Ford that I had, Crown Victoria, big wide chrome stripe down the side. And the amazing discovery that I made, I discovered that vomit destroys chrome. Because that was an unlucky drunk car. That car had been hit more times than Joe Louis, and I traded 3 or 4 years later after that. And this clown that I traded to looked at that car and said, well, what happened to that chrome stripe? I said, oh, this is not good. And so I said it was a manufacturer's defect. They didn't even have any manufacturer's defects in 1956, you know. But anyway, and so they very ceremoniously laid me in the back of my car and carried me home. At which point in time I started to call Ralph straight up, which was wonderful. Two good points about that, of course, is I wore glasses then, wear glasses now, and I didn't go blind, you know, because I had my glasses on. And then I didn't drown. You know, I wouldn't be here today. And so, but let me tell you now, you know, what happened, the story that I just told to you was told to me. I was 19 years old and blacked out, fellas. Normal drinkers don't have blackouts, the way I understand it. Normal drinkers don't do that. The old whiskey man progressed with me for years and years. I got married. I married this poor, long-suffering little old girl. We got divorced, and she married another wino, and then divorced him. I don't know what happened to her. But, you know, and before we got married, I got to tell you that she called it to my attention. She asked me, so why do you drink so much? You know, I was 23, 24 years old. I said, because I want to. And she swallowed that deal, hook, line, and sinker. I had her with the Dallas Country Club one night, gave her about 30,000 grasshoppers trying to intent on her body before we got married, and all she did was puke and throw up and never drink again. I'd puke, throw up, go get a drink in a heartbeat. I don't understand. Puke and throw up and pass out and not drink. Gee, man, Christmas, what a bad deal that is. I got to tell you that I've come a long way in the old disease of alcoholism. My dad was an alcoholic. My grandfather was an alcoholic. I come by my disease naturally, and it ain't any of their fault. Not a single solitary soul has ever set me down, put a funnel in my mouth, and made me take a drink. Nobody. I got my own self drunk. The whiskey man and I became very good friends. You know, this marriage had a couple of children in it. You know, I was a bright young executive at a bank, some kind of whoop-de-doo vice president. And, you know, we had a big high-dollar house out in North Dallas. It was wonderful. Had a Great Dane dog that was spotted, you know. And you look at this and say, look at this wonderful American family. Said, here's the little bright young bank executive with the bright young Brooks Brothers suits on. And here's the little girl, little junior leaguer. Everybody belonged to the country club. And the little boy for him, the little girl for here. For her and the big spotted dog and the Thunderbird car and all that, you know, everything just looked wonderful. You know, you look at that from the outside and say, hot ziggity zam, say, boy, what a good deal this is. Said, this guy, boy, he's luckier than anything. Say, oh, yeah, you know, pretty little wife and all this king business, all that material stuff. Let me tell you the way that really was, fellas. I was scared of her. She was scared of me. We were all scared of the big spotted dog, and the kids were absolutely crazy, you know. That's the way the deal was. You know, I'd come home, Jekyll Hyde, they wouldn't know what the hell was going on with me. They'd say, well, here's Daddy, hail fellow well met. Or here's Daddy, oh, leave me alone, because I'm, you know, just everything's going to be all right. You know, they wouldn't know what to expect. I didn't know what to expect. You know, I'd get two or three little shooters down at the bank, and folks would say, banks don't, you know, you don't drink at the bank. The banks I worked at, you drink, you know. Yeah, you know. But, and I'd come home, you know, with about half a bag on, and take only have two drinks at home, 32-ounce glass, full that far from the top with J&B Scotch whiskey and about 5 ice cubes, and just a little water in case you want to tone it down some. Just have two drinks. Drink a quart of whiskey every 2 nights, no problem. Did that for a long time. Whiskey man and I were wonderful friends. Then I don't know what happened. I drank whiskey for the same reason everybody else drinks whiskey. I drank whiskey for the effect. I liked the way whiskey made me feel.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your cassette over and continue to play on the other side. Thank you.
Then it made me tall, it made me beautiful, it made me smart, you know, it made me have a full head of curly hair, you know, whatever. I drank whiskey for the effect. I drank whiskey for the same reason that the guy up under the bridge drinks whiskey or the executive down at the petroleum club drinks whiskey, you know. I drank for the effect. It's just one of them deals. I liked what it did. And I drank that whiskey. I don't know about any of y'all. You know, we can drink that whiskey, it makes us laugh. We can make, drink that whiskey, it makes us sing. We can make it, drink that whiskey, it makes us make love. And we can drink that whiskey, it makes us dance. So I drink that whiskey, it makes us fight. Pull guns and stuff. You know. I don't know about any of y'all. I drank that whiskey, made me smart. Ooh, I get to drinking that J&B Scotch whiskey, and I could solve your problem, my problem, and anybody else's problem that was to ask. And as I continued to drink, I'd probably have a PhD in the same deal, you know, in the evening. But the whiskey man and I split the blanket, and he turned on me. And I came from a daily drinker to a daily drunk, and I don't know how old I was, probably 25. And that pattern continued to deteriorate for 10 years. Hanging on, hanging around, hanging up. You look at the outside, you look at the little boy for me, the little girl for her, the bright young wife, bright young business executive, big high-dollar house, spotted car, spotted dog, all that came in. It's wonderful. Look at the inside. It was terrifying. It was awful. And lo and behold, after going to the high-dollar head mechanic, the psychiatrist, I did not go to a marriage counselor that was not a physician. I went to the physician psychiatrist for marriage counseling. And I ran into a little storm on the sea of matrimony. I come home, found my bags packed one day. I said, oh, what a strange deal this is. But you know, in the eminent wisdom of an alcoholic, what I decided was this is okay. And you know, and so as I drove off into the sunset in my old model Chevrolet, looking at this high dollar house and this pretty little girl and this little boy for me, little girl for her, the big spotted dog, the Thunderbird car and all this other keen business, I looked back, looked at all that and said, huh, well, what's wrong with her? The bitch must be crazy. Got rid of me, the best deal in Dallas County. Said, boy, this is all right for me. Said, now I can drink a little whiskey uninterrupted. Folks will leave me alone, and I can chase a few girls. I don't know about any of y'all, but the whiskey man affected me a little differently than it affects some fellas. I was 35 years old when I come in this deal and probably been impotent for 18 months. And so I was one of the guys, if I caught a gal, it'd be like a dog had caught a car. You kind of say, well, what's all that about? But the whiskey drinking went okay for a little while. And I was the whippity-doo vice president at this bank. I was a shareholder of record of the largest minority share block. You really don't want to do that if you can help it, because there ain't no market. And I was on the loan committee. I was employee of longest tenure. I made $15,000 a year, whether I needed it or not. And on the board of directors. And the bank had become insolvent at one time. And then I put a deal together with some other fellows to purchase the bank. And so, you know, I was in that shareholder group and all that came in. And the only reason I was doing that is for job protection. Oftentimes, the last thing that goes away with a man is a job, the practicing male alcoholic. That's been my experience. And I got to tell you that they let the breeze hit me where the bulldog bit me. I absolutely could not believe it. I said, well, these monkeys, they'll be broke here in about 10 minutes. That was 17 years ago, and the bank just went broke last summer. I told them they'd never make it. But left to my own devices, of course. So what I did is say, well, I need to go on a white wing hunt. I'd already been in the Presbyterian hospital for being unable to come off a little old minor drunk that I'd been on. Nothing major now. A little old 10-dayer or something. But I was not up on the 7th floor of Presbyterian Hospital, gentlemen. The 7th floor of Presbyterian Hospital has got some architectural defects in it. The doors don't have no knobs on your side. And I was down on the 3rd floor of Presbyterian Hospital in the gastroenteritis section with me and the rest of the drunks getting all dried out. And that was in June or July, and this was up in September, October, whatever. And I said, well, here I am without a job. What I really need to do, I need to get with the rest of some Ford dealers that I knew, and we need to go on a white wing hunt to Mexico. And so that's what I did. And in the Cadillac bar in Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, I picked up what was to be the ending of my last drink, because I've been controlling my drinking a little wine. And in front of all these fellows, I said, well, you know what I need to do? I said, I'll just believe I'll have a margarita. And y'all know the end of that story. You know, you could have poured it in number 9 wash tub, been about 3 inches deep by the time it was all over. and I picked up the hardball, and I got home and I sent out for a gallon of scotch and a gallon of vodka and two TV dinners, and they all run out about the same time, because you know. And what happened to me, of course, you know, is that I ran out of airspeed, altitude, and ideas, and the whiskey man had me by everywhere he could have me, and I knew that I had to get out of the place I was going to get out of, or I was going to die. And I went to a friend of mine's house, and I knew he'd have some vodka, and I went over and I drank his vodka, and then they rescued me that day, and thank God called my first sponsor, Dave Lane, and I have his permission to break his anonymity. Dave sobered up in 1945, and is sober as I speak tonight in Scottsdale, Arizona. And Dave and I served on the board of this bank, and they called Dave and said, "Well, what are we going to do with him? You know, have y'all ever been talked about like that? What are we going to do with him this time? This time, you know, they done had a dose of me before." And they said, "Well, I don't know." Says Brooks, "There's a place you can go." And I said, "Good." And they said, "Brooks, it's based on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "I don't care." And then my friend told me, he said, and Brooks, it takes 28 days. And I looked him dead straight in the eye and said, "I don't give a damn if it takes 28 years. And what had happened right there, fellas, I had started to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Because God's grace had entered my life. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, when it talks about first we start to recover spiritually, and then the physical and mental emotions get sorted out. I started to recover, and that was God's grace, that opening grace for me that let me start to recover. I'm at my sponsor now in that jitter joint. I don't mean to insult anybody, hurt anybody's feelings. There's some fellas in here that were there when I was there, Herb and Larry and some others. Goony Roost. Spin dry joint. Jitter joint. For us folks more sensitive and intelligent like me, Alcoholic Rehabilitation Center. They got me in the drunk farm. And it was really kind of embarrassing, fellas, because I drunk all this friend of mine's vodka and I had to have me a drink of brown whiskey at 10 o'clock in the morning on October the 17th, 1973. I haven't had a drink since. The only thing that says is that I haven't had a drink. That damn sure doesn't say that I haven't needed one. Damn sure doesn't say I haven't wanted one. But I haven't had one. That's what we're all about. That's what we're all about. The first couple of steps for me were reflective. They're one of them, "Oh, I've done that step. Oh, I understand," you know. They were passive. They weren't very busy steps. Well, let me tell you, fellas, the rest of the steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the traditions have been steady busy for me. You make some lists, you make some prayers, you make some phone calls, you make some other lists, make some more prayers, you talk to somebody else, you go make an amend, then you go back and make this, and then you go, and then you continue to do this, and as we continue to take this inventory, and as we grow, and as we change, and as we do things different, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has kept me plenty busy. Plenty busy. The steps. The first three steps, I think, steps 1, 2, and 3, have got me squared around with God. And steps 4, 5, 6, and 7 have got me squared around myself so I can really find a Brooks Bell that might be in there and obscured by all the BS. And steps 8 and 9 have got me squared around with y'all. And steps 10, 11, and 12 have let me stay that way on a daily basis. There are certain keys to the steps. The key to the first step for me has been honesty. The key to the second step has been an open mind. The key to the third step has been willingness. The key to steps 4 through 9 for me have been courage, because sometimes it takes great courage to do these steps. The key to the 10th step has been, for me, on the continuance, a little perseverance. The key to the 11th step has been a little patience. The 11th step tells me God and I don't wear the same wristwatch. God answers all my prayers. He says, yes, no, wait a while. You got to be kidding. You got to watch what you pray for. It'll happen in a heartbeat. Happen in God's time, not yours. The key to the 12th step for me has been love. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is plenty serious to me. But we absolutely insist on having a good time. I think, fellas, what we do is that we work with drunks. That's our primary purpose. We carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. We need to do that on a consistent basis. We need to do that on a daily basis. And I think the reason that we knew that and need to do that is because when the police and the probation judges and the preachers and the psychologists and the psychiatrists and the parents and the physicians, when they've all given up, we can take that little drunk and say, come on in here, partner. Come on in here and get you a cup of coffee and sit down. Come on in here and sit on your hands if you have to. This is our message. This is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You've found a home. Welcome. Stay in our home groups. Be loyal in our attendance. Be generous in our giving. If you can't give of money, give time. If you can't give of time, give resources, loyalty. AA World Service today is concerned about two main things. They're concerned about the deterioration of the home group, and they're concerned about the primary purpose message. It is up to us, the ones that are in recovery today, to maintain the primary purpose. It is up to us, the ones that are in recovery today, to maintain our home groups. If you haven't got a home group and you live in Dallas, come to mine. If you have got a home group, stay in it and participate in your own recovery. If you don't like the way the group is, keep coming back and make it better. The answer is not to run away. The answer is to stay. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is always about. We're about patience and tolerance and love. We're about understanding. We're about carrying the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. Because you see, fellas, when everybody else has given up, when everybody else has pitched the towel in, we can do the deal. We can do the deal. I've seen it happen time and time and time again. My son, as I share with you tonight, my son needs this program. He's told me, Dad, I have a drinking problem. And I said, well, you better quit. That's what they told me for years. What can I say? Hell, I've been sober 16, 17 years. If the little old monkey don't get the message, it ain't my fault. He knows the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works. He knows it works. And he needs it. That's why the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, fellas, has got to stay the same. That's why the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the message is the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. If you've got a drinking problem, we have a drinking solution. Thank God for the young people coming into AA today. I'm probably the only old man wino in this room, just a straight alcoholic. Maybe one or two others. Young folks coming in today have got problems other than booze. Thank God for them, because they can carry the message to the young folks. Thank God for that. But, anybody can come in AA today. And they can all come, but they can't all stay. It's kind of like them big old dances out in West Texas, one of them deals. But when we carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers, and the new fella, the new gal coming in, and they've got some other problems, they're more than welcome. as long as one of their problems is drinking. If you haven't got a drinking problem, you need to go somewhere else. And I guarantee you, with 350 12-step programs of recovery, all based on AA, if you can't find something to suit your pistol, you ain't looking. That's what we're about. That's what we're about in my group. We talk about not drinking whiskey. I was in the drunk farm, and a fellow named Ray come down and sat on my bed. Ray was to drink again, damn near died in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Tried to sell me racehorses and stuff. Call up in the morning, drunker than the Lord. Want to buy a racehorse, Brooks? I says, what are you doing? Ray says, well, I'm out here drinking. I said, you having a good time? He said, oh, hell yeah. Ray's over up in Wino Row in Santa Fe, New Mexico, finally. But Ray brought the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me, the first rattle out of the box. Ray come in and sat down on my bed in the drunk farm, and me having the great yellow Godamighties and looking out the window and saying, ooh, what is all this about? You know, I just come to and looked out the window and saw that beer joint sign. Old Bill and I was the same place. And he come in and he sat down on my bed, and he looked at me and he looked me dead straight in the eye, and I knew absolutely he knew from whence he spoke, and he said the 10 most important words I've ever heard in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, I know how you feel. How can I help you? That's what AA is all about. That's what we do best. Folks that experience the phenomenon of craving after taking a drink of whiskey, those are the ones that we know how they feel and how can we help them. I told you I don't know how the program works, and I really don't. I know that it works. It really does. And that's one of the shortest sentences in the Big Blue Book. I know it'll work for me, and it's worked for you. It works in good times and in bad. I'm one of them guys that come into AA about half rich. I'll tell you, in the last 17, 18 years, I didn't come in smart. I come in about half rich, taking $1.5 million estate and reduced it to less than 50,000. I'm really making great progress. So, little errors in judgment here and there. You know, what can I say? One of them deals. I'm okay with that for the most part. I'm okay with that. If you're new, if you're coming back, stick and stay. Don't let anybody take your seat. Don't let anybody take your seat. There's not a soul in the world that can take my seat in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've earned every inch of it, and I intend to keep it. Fellas, if they had nobody told you they love you today, I do, and I will. I love you. Thanks for having me.